the first degree.
First degree.
First degree.
First degree.
First degree.
First degree.
The first degree.
These things are supposed to happen in movies, not in real life.
There have been claims and allegations made about Keith going way back previous to NXIVM, and certainly continue into NXIVM, about his relationship with underage girls. That's very disturbing. And, you know, he spent a lot of time, in addition to like his sermons or speeches or whatever you want to call them, about how men are inherently, you know, or women are inherently inferior to men. He also talked a lot about how the age of consent and having sex with minors is a kind of social construct and something that is actually just like imposed on us. And he seemed to really sanction this idea of pedophilia.
Welcome to The First Degree, the true crime podcast that you might end up on. My name is Jack Fanick. I'm sitting very far away from Alexis Linkletter and very far away from Billy Jensen. So today's episode is going to be pretty straightforward, and we're not doing killing time because it doesn't really feel right at the moment. And we did want to let our listeners know that we're going to be actively searching for more cases involving Black and people of color that are usually underrepresented or completely forgotten about in the media. And we promise to do our best to help fight the injustice in our country and give a voice to the people and stories that otherwise go untold. But our podcast is crowdsourced and relies almost completely on our first degree guests and their willingness to share their story. So please, if you or someone you know wants us to amplify their voice and tell their story, please email us at hello@thefirstdegreepodcast.com. And Billy, what day is it today?
It's kind of slim pickings, but I'm going to go with National Ballpoint Pen Day.
Wow. That's not the best day out of all of the days.
National Urban Spice Day.
I do love National Urban Spice over a ballpoint pen. I haven't picked up a pen in like 3 months.
The pen is mightier than the sword.
Haven't you ever had that perfect ballpoint pen that glides on the paper and it just brings you such simple joy?
There's so few around these days because you don't buy them. So you have to poach them at offices. And
that is true. You steal, you have
it's
to
hard
steal
to get
offices.
That. It's hard to find them
the
these
pen
days.
Finds
or hotels.
You.
It's true.
The pen finds you. All right. Well, that's a sad day, but that's enough of that. So let's turn down the lights.
And turn up your anxiety.
Because this could be you.
The story of how Keith Raniere became an international self-help guru and later a convicted sex cult leader is truly one of those cautionary tales that's not unfamiliar. A man who's a master of manipulation, but otherwise generally not at all exceptional, is able to seduce, exploit, alienate, and control countless individuals after developing keen abilities to select precise prey, bait them, and slowly coerce them into doing exactly what he wants them to do. So, how exactly did Keith Raniere do it? Well, to answer that, we're going to have to go back to the beginning.
So today's case takes us back to Clifton Park, an Albany neighborhood in upstate New York. A quaint suburb peppered with shopping centers and two-story colonial homes. And it's quite unassuming when considering that a dangerous cult was born there. And it's here that a man named Keith Raniere grew up and planted roots that he would return to throughout his life as he transformed into a cult leader.
Keith Raniere was born in Brooklyn on August 26, 1960. His father worked in advertising, and his mother was a ballroom dancing instructor. As an adult, Keith later described his mother as a terrible alcoholic, and she actually died when Keith was only 17. But while he was born in Brooklyn, as a kid, the family moved to Suffern, which is in upstate New York. And according to a CBC article, Keith's father, James Raniere, said that when his son was 7 or 8 years old, he took an intelligence test that determined that the boy was gifted. He then noticed a dramatic change in the boy's character when he learned the results. It was almost like a switch went off. And suddenly, overnight, he turned into like Jesus Christ. And that he was superior and better than everybody, like a deity. And looking back, many believe this is when and where the seed of Keith's narcissism was planted. Keith attended a Waldorf school, and if you're not familiar with Waldorf education, these types of schools focus on intellectual, artistic, and practical skills with much more abstract teaching practices. Generally speaking, the cultivation of the student's imagination and creativity is the primary focus rather than traditional academics.
It's at this point that we're going to introduce to you our first degree for today's episode, Josh Block, who got sucked into this story when he ran into an old childhood friend named Sarah Edmondson. Josh, who was already working at the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, decided to document his journey into the world of a cult called Nexium. And he ultimately created, produced, and hosted the podcast Uncover, Escaping Nexium, which took an in-depth look at Keith Raniere's life, including how he learned to use his story and use the story of others to create and control a secretive world. And Josh actually went to Albany, New York to try to track down information about Keith Raniere's childhood.
But it was a difficult part of the investigation to try and dig back into his past and figure out, like, who is this guy and where does he come from? And unfortunately, his parents, weren't available to talk to us. But yeah, we did learn a few interesting things about, you know, him as a kid, and this is according to one of his ex-girlfriends and a former member of Nexium, but that from an early age, he had this kind of messiah complex. He really did believe and told his parents that he was, like, enlightened and was both, you know, had somehow had some, like, you know, greater access to his both physical and mental capacities. You know, he claimed to be a chess player and piano player and all sorts of things.
And as far as Keith's childhood social life was concerned, his parents recalled that when Keith was as young as 13 years old, he had swaths of girls calling him who were in love with him. And apparently, Keith's mother would pick up the phone and occasionally catch snippets of his conversations. And she noticed that he told every girl he spoke to the very same thing. Quote, "I love you. You're special. You're important." And again, he was saying this to each and every girl, so clearly he didn't truly mean it. But when he was as young as 13, he was piecing together and learning that people, mainly women or girls that he was talking to, liked to hear these things.
He also, from an early age, was a Don Juan. I mean, he was very, very active in convincing women and even girls in his teenage years that, you know, he had sort of multiple partners and often would spend a lot of time convincing them that that was the kind of relationship that they had to allow him to have.
By 1982, Keith graduated from RPI in Troy, New York, after majoring in math, biology, and physics. But his GPA at graduation was a mere 2.26. Again, nothing extraordinary as far as his scholastic achievement.
And Keith had many, many girlfriends in his 20s, and a common theme he echoed to each and every one of them was this: men are hardwired to be polyamorous, but women are not. And that the only reason his romantic arrangement seems wrong to others is because people are brainwashed by society's flawed values. So he would convince women to be in open relationships with him, even though they didn't want to. And he started having a group of women around him all of the time. And at this point, he wasn't profiting off of them. He was honing his ability to manipulate and control them. After college, Keith worked at Amway. And for those of you that don't know, is a huge MLM or multi-level marketing scheme or company. And they sold vitamins and beauty products. And this is where presumably Keith learned the ropes of MLMs and pyramid schemes in general. And he was taking notes, because Amway was the company that primed and inspired Keith to build a similarly structured business of his own.
He started a multi-level marketing company and then eventually before starting Nexium as well. But there was always this kind of, like, going back certainly to his college years, this kind of feeling of, like, a entourage of people and especially young women around him that were infatuated with him, that were kind of, like, really believed that if they hitched their wagon to him, they would see huge success. And it wasn't clear, you know, in the early years, whether that success was just going to be financial or whether there was some kind of more spiritual path they were going to take.
Now, as many cult leaders do, Keith cultivated a community of friends that others wanted to be a part of. He lived at home in Albany with one of his girlfriends. But there always seemed to be a group of kind of hippie women there with him. And they would all stay up late and talk about philosophy and religion and money. Mainly, they would talk about how they could all become rich. And according to the CBC, Keith was fascinated by Scientology and talked about it constantly. He talked about neuro-linguistic programming, NLP, a personal development discipline popular back then that focuses on using perception and communication techniques to change people's thoughts and behaviors. And it's at this phase that he began to conceptualize what would become NXIVM.
Following Keith's time at Amway, he opened a company called Consumers Byline. And according to the Times Union, quote, Consumers Byline Inc. was a nationwide buying club offering discounts to members who could become affiliates and recruit more members, an OG MLM. So this company employed more than 150 people in offices in Clifton Park, which is in Albany, and directed dozens of sales representatives nationwide. So the company then collapsed amid a slew of civil actions from more than 20 U.S. states. So it's no shock that Keith ultimately closed Consumers Byline once he caught wind that various state and federal authorities started to receive complaints and suspect that Keith was running a pyramid scheme. So Keith closed his doors before an official investigation could be launched. And like all good aspiring cult leaders do, he then reinvented himself. He decided to change his entire persona. He would now be an expert in health, wellness, and a self-help guru.
And Keith's next endeavor included opening a health store with a girlfriend that he had at the time, a woman named Toni Natalie. And it's here at the store that Keith met a person that would end up being very significant in his life, as well as in the diabolical cult that would soon come to be, a woman named Nancy Salzman. And what I'm about to say is not a joke. Nancy actually came into their health store looking for a cure to her chronic constipation. Former followers have made jokes about her saying, quote, the woman is literally full of shit. So regardless of her reason for entering the store initially, these two developed the pillars of the NXIVM curriculum.
One of the fascinating components of NXIVM was the public-facing side of it were these expensive self-help workshops so that you would pay, you know, $2,000 or $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000 or $10,000 to take one of their courses. And thousands of people took them. They had like something like 20,000 people took those courses. And for the vast majority of people, that was their only interaction with NXIVM. And there obviously was like, you have to have a strong hook. You have to, you can't just like jump right to the stuff that's crazy and bananas. Like you have to sort of slowly pull people in. And that hook that they had was good. And we talked to a lot of people who said, you know what, those courses were great. Like they borrowed from all sorts of different modalities and people found that they were helpful in sorting out like either relationship issues or financial issues or just like, you know, personal goals and that kind of thing. So they had that piece, which I think was powerful. And it also was one of the reasons that they were able to really attract a certain more wealthy, high functioning group of people. Like they weren't targeting marginalized groups.
So who is this Nancy Salzman, you ask? And what did Keith see in her? Why did he pick her out of all of these women that he had around him? Why did he pick her to partner up with? Nancy was a nurse and a skilled hypnotherapist. And she was also very well nursed in the neuro-linguistic programming, which is that form of therapy that uses tactics such as body language mirroring and hypnotherapy to help followers overcome personal obstacles. And side note, by the way, this type of therapy is often dismissed as pseudoscience. But it's also the same type of therapy that Keith was fascinated with. So this is exactly the kind of manipulation Keith wanted to master, or at least have a partner who was an expert in the subject to aid in sucking people in, learning their deepest secrets, and then exploiting them.
Keith's girlfriend, Toni, eventually broke up with him, and she was then pressured by Keith and this band of women to take him back. And according to a CBC article, quote, when that failed, they stole her mail, they hacked her in her hard drives, they basically stole her identity, and they filed multiple lawsuits accusing her of stealing money from Keith. Strategies they would use against her and any other perceived enemies of Keith for almost two decades going forward. So this is something they adopted very early on, lawsuits as a weapon, weaponizing the legal system. So, and this is one of the first glimpses into this tactic that he would use from then on. He would threaten people with costly financial action and litigation and tie people up in court indefinitely, causing them to hemorrhage money. Threats of this kind in retaliation kept people in line and kept people from leaving him.
And with Nancy, Keith co-founded a company called Executive Success Programs, and this would eventually morph into Nexium. This company would offer self-help courses. And as far as the teachings, the ideology was simple. It started with the buildup of Keith Raniere. He must always be on a pedestal. And Keith described himself as one of the world's top three problem solvers. He claimed that he spoke in complete sentences by age one, and by age two, he was reading. He also claimed to be the most intelligent person in the world. And people believed him. Why? Well, his charm, his charisma, and the years of studying the subtle art of manipulation.
Yeah, remember, this is a guy that got a 2.26 at RPI, most intelligent person.
Most intelligent person in the world.
So as far as the promises of Nexium, Keith didn't just promise to unlock clients' greater potential. He claimed that his methods could abate symptoms of Tourette syndrome and even help kids speak to up to 13 languages. New members were told that Keith was a truly enlightened being, and if you followed his carefully crafted system, you'll be able to reach your true potential and inadvertently change the world for the better in the process. And as we know, this is a common ideology with cults. We saw this in Jonestown. Manson did some of this too. And this idea of making the world a better place sucks in those well-intentioned individuals. And before they even realize what's happened, they're in really deep.
You know, I've known about cults, but certainly this was like more of my education around them. And one of the interesting things is that they are all so similar. Like you start to look at three or four of them and you're like, oh my God, it's all operating the same way. You have like one charismatic figure in the center and they have like certain kind of coercive tactics, you know, cutting people off from family, using a rarefied language, having a strict hierarchy, you know, telling you that you have some kind of like fundamental deficiency that only they can help. There's a few like key things that happen again and again, that they all sort of operate from the same playbook.
Nexium, like Consumers Byline, operated like an MLM. It was mandatory that followers recruited new followers. And the reward for a successful recruit? You would get a cut of the fees the new members would pay for courses. Then these new followers would have to pay for courses to keep cash flowing into the business, and they would need to recruit as well. And the money just kept going up and up the pyramid.
And then using just a very coercive tactic that stopped people being allowed to question anything that was happening in the system and to question themselves. So, you know, we just heard the account again and again that the longer people stayed with the Nexium, the worse they felt. And then the more money they were spending on Nexium courses to try and make themselves feel better. But having, you know, the higher ranked people in the organizations and superiors really using these kind of psychological tactics to make people feel crappy about themselves and to sort of make them dependent on the group.
Nancy Keith's methods worked. Nexium took off.
Those who bought into Nexium were taught that essentially you are responsible for everything that happens in your life, all of your successes, all of your failures, every thought and emotion, every intention. The problem is that your belief system is full of faulty, quote-unquote, programming that has accumulated since childhood and holds you back with fear and other unnecessary emotions. The CBC wrote in an article, quote, "If anything you're asked to do as part of the training seems odd or ill-advised, like paying thousands of dollars for more training, or allowing your quote-unquote coach to discipline you for failing to meet your goals, well, that's probably just your faulty programming talking, and is precisely why you need to stick with the lessons."
So new recruits paid more than $7,500 for grueling 12-hour quote-unquote intensives featuring Nexium's patented executive success program technology. And these were methods that he plucked from various self-help programs, religious ideologies, and hypnosis techniques that came before Nexium. And according to a Rolling Stone article, quote, a former Nexium member in its early years says that after she left the group, she recognized many ESP techniques in the book Stress Management for Dummies. So this is obviously not groundbreaking therapy, stealing it from a million different places. And despite all this, Nexium expanded throughout the entire United States.
Keith continued to seduce followers and began recruiting new members from Mexico and Canada. And it was in Vancouver that a woman named Sarah Edmondson was introduced to Nexium.
Sarah Edmondson is a central figure in this story and within Nexium for a number of reasons. But we're going to start with the fact that she and Josh, our first degree, grew up together.
The first time I heard about Nexium was like these Vanity Fair articles and occasionally stuff that would be passed among friends about this weird organization that we kind of knew Sarah was a part of, but never really had a strong sense of what it was. It was like this lifestyle, self-helpy thing. And, you know, it was very occasional that that some article would pop up. So I kind of knew of Nexium, but not really what it was. Obviously not the full extent of what it was. Sarah Edmondson, who was a childhood friend of mine who I went to daycare with, who I kind of had lost touch with over the years, I ran into her one summer. And we were catching up and she literally was like, hey, I've just left a cult. Slowly started to explain what she meant. And it was interesting though. So Sarah had just left Nexium about a month earlier and had been inside that organization for 12 years. And the organization has this like rarefied language and they really like, it's a really a bubble. Once you're in it, you're inside it. And your friends and your whole life and your work is Nexium. So her ability at that stage, even to like fully explain to me what she was a part of and what it was limited. Like there was a lot of gobbledygook, a lot of language I didn't understand. She was still processing kind of what happened to her. And eventually, you know, at one stage she said, women in the group have been branded on their bodies. And then a couple of days later, she said, you know, I told you that women had been branded, but actually I am one of those women. And then, you know, that was like quite something to hear. And I started to appreciate the, just how kind of extreme the group might be. And at that moment, I mean, Nexium was like fully operational, and there were courses running and it was vibrant and there was no indication. And Sarah very much knew this, like other people had tried to leave the group before and it didn't tend to go super well. Like either you left super quietly and you were allowed to leave or they come after you and they come after you in the courts. So it was a pretty, like, she was pretty wound up and freaked out. And I definitely was like, something's going on here. And I need to start recording it. So we started kind of recording our phone conversations pretty early on in that process. Fortunately, I was working at the CBC, at the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation at that time, and had this story. I didn't quite know what to do with it yet, too. I didn't quite have the full picture or the language, but fortunately, the podcast department had been in operation for a couple of years, and we kind of marched over there and said, well, I had this story. Are you interested? And they said, yes. And that's how the thing, you know, started to get made. I mean, they sort of like backed us and allowed us to jump in with both feet.
Sarah would thrive in Nexium. And eventually she was put in charge of running the Vancouver flagship location. And this location would become significant to Nexium for a number of reasons. Not only because of Sarah Edmondson's connection to the group, but it was also where Keith snagged his first celebrity member. And this aspect of celebrity is key in legitimizing groups like this. A good example, of course, is Scientology.
Scientology rules at this. I mean, they have like Tom Cruise, Kirstie Alley, the guy who plays Chef on South Park, Will Smith, right? Who else?
John Travolta.
John Travolta.
John Travolta.
There are a lot of others.
Nexium was really stretching with their celebrity outreach.
They were, but you know what? Like, I think that Scientology, I've never seen
a cult do better. Like, that cult is thriving still. And they've got the best properties in Los Angeles. I have no idea how they did it.
But they're thriving still when their members are dwindling. They're somehow still thriving.
Okay, so let's talk about one of NXIVM's first and most prominent quote-unquote celebrity members. So back in 2006, Smallville was a show that was kind of a pop culture phenomenon. People still talk about it today. And one of this show's actresses was named Allison Mack. And she attended a two-day introduction to NXIVM in Vancouver. So according to a Yahoo News article, quote, the program was billed as a women's movement workshop within NXIVM. And the then 23-year-old actress attended with thousands of other people from around the world. So Allison Mack was actually living in Vancouver, Canada, because that's where she filmed Smallville. And that's where the whole production took place. And she had attended the program with her co-star, Kristen Kreuk, who played the Lana Lang character on the show, by the way. So once Allison Mack was hooked, Keith instructed all members to roll out the red carpet for her. The hope being, of course, that she could attract more influential members, more members with notoriety. So after Smallville ended in 2011, Allison Mack struggled to find work and began to immerse herself even deeper into NXIVM, hoping that the practices and the curriculum could help her sort of elevate her acting career. And meanwhile, slowly, she was withdrawing from her friends and family members, another common characteristic of kind of cult behavior.
Okay, so back to Sarah Edmondson. She was key in recruiting a certain member that would make challenging or escaping NXIVM nearly impossible. So according to Forbes, Sarah persuaded Claire Bronfman, who is the heiress to the Seagram's liquor fortune, to join NXIVM.
You know, the other like big win for them was obviously convincing these two Bronfman sisters, Sarah and Claire Bronfman, to hand over or donate or invest hundreds of millions of dollars into the company, into the organization, which allowed it to really have clout and sway for what would otherwise be a pretty small little rinky-dinky operation in Albany, New York. Suddenly they had a huge amount of resources at their disposal, so that allowed them to fly people around on a private jet and kind of woo them, and it as kind of proof of the executive success and the achievements that they had. It also allowed them to hire many lawyers and go after their detractors in an aggressive and very expensive way. I mean, they squandered a huge amount of money in the courts, you know, on frivolous cases, really, to scare off their critics.
And Claire was so committed that she bought a house near NXIVM's headquarters in Clifton Park, New York, and a horse farm up the road. Claire rose in the ranks to become Ranieri's right-hand woman and the most cutthroat defender.
Allison Mack was then invited to fly via private jet to Albany to meet with Keith, who promised to help Allison take her acting career to the next level.
But you saw the elements of what, you know, eventually he becomes known as Vanguard in NXIVM, and you saw those elements that clearly he liked that adoration and that kind of connection. And, you know, it's interesting because we talked to people that knew him back in that day, and just that account of, you know, he's not obvious when you see him and you hear him speak. He's not the kind of like bigger than life Tony Robbins figure that, like, you know, swoops into a room. He's quite, he's like a short guy. He's not like crazy attractive. He's not particularly like charismatic on first pass. But people talk about this ability that, like, when you are talking to him, he just totally locks into you and you feel like he understands you and he gets you and he is able to build this rapport and make this connections with people. That again and again, we heard that account, but it just felt like you were the only person in the room when he was talking to you. And I suppose that's not surprising. Like, you, that someone who was able to build an organization like he did has that quality, is able to be a leader in that way and able to connect with people in that way.
And as NXIVM's notoriety grew, smaller groups were also established under this NXIVM umbrella. First, there was The Source, which is a workshop for actors that was led by Allison Mack. Then there was a group called The Delegates, which is kind of a tech startup staffed by younger female members. Then there was JNES, which is a female empowerment group. And JNES taught members that men inherently had more character and fortitude than women, who were prone to flightiness and game playing. And to Keith, game playing meant deceit and deception and manipulation. What's interesting, though, is that Keith publicly advocated for women to have leadership roles at NXIVM. He admitted that the company would be better if there were women in power, but Keith clearly did not install women in high-ranking positions within NXIVM because he thought they were smarter or stronger or better qualified.
Right, and he did it because he believed that he could control them. After all, it's a lot easier to recruit new women members if a female recruit oversees the largely female executive board, because they would assume that the company must promote the interests of women themselves. However, the misogyny in NXIVM's teachings was undeniable. And if you're wondering why this was tolerated and even appealed to the women in the group, a Rolling Stone article framed all this in a way that was pretty fascinating. It said, quote, "Some of the women in NXIVM had come of age in an era of body positive Dove ads and girl power messaging and had largely felt failed by its promises. And having sampled all the wellness industry's offerings and the path to enlightenment, the teas, the classes, the pastel hued self-help paperbacks, the meditation apps, the rose quartz vagina tightening sticks, many felt disillusioned and more spiritually depleted than before. And for many of these women, the goal wasn't so much towards enlightenment or even fulfillment, so much as it was just feeling some semblance of okay. But the journey towards self-love proved so exhausting that the prospect of simply accepting their biological fate and ceding all of their power to men proved not just alluring, but irresistible."
Right. And the quote continues, quote, "The women all look somewhat familiar in their early 30s to mid-40s, dark-eyed, tastefully dressed. Above all else, they were slender, almost painfully so. Ranieri was obsessed with controlling women's weight, to the degree that some of their fingers became stained with the color of carrots and squash they were exclusively instructed to eat for dinner. He was unabashed about weaponizing their insecurities about weight, telling one partner that the extra 10 pounds she'd gained, quote, hurts my heart physically, and then refusing to sleep with her until she shed them."
I'd have to say, number one, I think something that pretty much every woman in the world struggles with is body image and weight. And I think that Keith knew exactly what he was doing by using weight and controlling weight as a weapon against these women and to like tear them down in the easiest and most destructive ways by trying to control what they're eating and what they look like. And then not sleeping with them as a punishment. Like, that's textbook manipulation tactic.
Right. And he's so the kind of dude, especially if he likes like the same type of woman. He likes dark hair. He likes brown eyes. He likes them all to be skinny. He wants to have like a bunch of fembots around him. Like, that's what he's trying to curate, an army of the same sort of looking women who believe the same and fawn on him. And it's just, it's like the Austin, it's like fembots. Like, that's what he wants. He wants them to be like by design exactly how he wants them to be. He wants them to all look the same, tastefully dressed, all this stuff, preaching the same stuff he's taught them. It's very indicative of a cult leader, as we can tell.
So continuing on the subject of NXIVM's offshoot groups, there was also an all-men's group called the Society of Protectors. In this group, a co-ed SOP module gave female members tiaras or princess wands for being too princessy. Then one woman wearing a low-cut top to a meeting was given a blue ribbon for showing off her, quote, udders.
Yeah, I mean, it's very dehumanizing. So up until now, there's no doubt that Keith was a con man, a master manipulator, and someone who financially exploits individuals who sign up to be members of NXIVM. But here's where the criminal and cruel acts facilitated by the group come to light for real. So at the height of NXIVM, Keith had hundreds of followers who would hang on his every word and address him as quote-unquote Vanguard. That was his name. He was sleeping with a band of women on rotation and kind of pinning them against each other too. But Keith and Allison Mack were working behind the scenes as well. And she was, at his command, quietly cultivating a group of the most elite female NXIVM members to join what she described essentially as a feminist group called quote-unquote DOS, which was the most sinister of NXIVM's offshoot groups. DOS stood for Dominus Obsequious Sororium, which means master over the slave woman.
So Doss used fraud and extortion tactics to take advantage of the women in the group. And they did this to get money out of them, to make them perform physical labor, and to coerce them into having sex with Keith. And much of this involved handing over collateral, which included videos of themselves masturbating or quote-unquote confessions that had relatives sexually molesting them. And they were ordered to text their quote-unquote masters up-close photos of their unshaven genitals. Their face had to be in the photos, so their identities were made clear. It's an obvious what is happening.
Yeah.
And their diets were controlled. They had to remain skinny, like we were saying before. And they had to wake up in the middle of the night to perform military-type drills.
They were also not allowed to engage in other sexual relationships other than the ones that they were having with Keith. So this is all typical textbook behavior that we've seen over and over again.
In terms of DOS, you've given over a collateral to be part of the group, and the collateral had to be, you know, would have to destroy your life if it was released. So it's very damaging: nude photos, videos, false confessions or real confessions about loved ones, about crimes you might have committed or haven't committed but are confessing to them. And you had to re-up on these, like, you know, your collateral would every month you have to continue to like put more collateral in the bank. And with that over their head, you know, there's one woman who testified that she was instructed by her master within that system that she had to go seduce Keith. And she feared if she did not comply with that, that her collateral would be released. You know, another focus of the charges against Keith were to do with a woman who was essentially banished, confined to a room for over a year because she had like breached the moral code she was basically had a crush on someone she shouldn't have a crush on. She was supposed to be devoted to Keith, but she kind of admitted to having a crush on someone else. And she was stuck in this room and wasn't allowed to leave. And they held on to her. She was from Mexico and held on to her papers. I mean, she wasn't even like actually able to leave the country. And the confinement had multiple layers to it. And her, unfortunately, her parents were consenting to this punishment as well. But she, you know, stubbornly just sat there for over a year.
And if you think we're done telling you all the shitty things about DOS, we're not.
They were forced to buy sex toys for use in a dungeon that was slated to be built in a future DOS headquarters. And according to court documents, this dungeon would include cages, vibrating rubber paddles, and puppy plugs, perfect for puppy play or naughty slaves, end quote. Also according to court documents, quote, the women Keith slept with were told that women who swallowed his semen sometimes saw an ethereal blue light, and that those who refused to participate in a group oral sex session weren't, quote, committed to their personal growth. And Keith set all of this up as a means for much more than sex with multiple women whenever he wanted. He had such control over them that if one of his girlfriends was unhappy, or one of them broke the rules, other members of the inner circle were tasked with bringing them back into the fold, and they were also tasked with punishing them. And one of the most controversial things that happened within DOS was branding. Not all of them were branded, but those who were later talked about how excruciatingly painful it was, how you could hear the cauterizing pen sizzle against raw skin. The brand itself was a carefully crafted design that merged Keith and Allison Mack's initials. But the women receiving this permanent mark had no idea that they were getting the initials of two cult leaders seared onto them forever. They just thought it was a design. And like I said, not all members of DOS were branded, but Sarah Edmondson was.
So here's how the branding ritual played out. The women were supposed to be naked. They were meant to be taped, videotaped, I mean. They were held down on a table with their arms above their wrists, and they were bound. They were ordered to say the following, quote, please brand me. It would be an honor I want to wear for the rest of my life. And according to court documents, when Keith was coming up with the plans for this ritual, he said to Allison Mack, I mean, they were in a brainstorming session, oh, actually, they should probably say that before they're held down, so it doesn't seem like they were being coerced into this. This is how this man thinks. So the procedure itself was supposed to be 7 sears with a soldering iron. One line across and 2 diagonal lines down form the sideways K. Then 4 smaller lines to form the sideways R beneath the little spoon to the big spoon of the K. So Allison Mack, who herself had been branded, told the women after the branding was complete that, quote, pain is how we know how much we love. We know the depth of our love through pain. When they feel pain, they think of that love.
Okay, so another extremely messed up thing about DOS is the women had no idea that Keith was connected to it at all. They had no idea that the group was completely under Keith's control, and they believed it was solely Allison's group, that it was this women's empowerment group. And they were told by Allison Mack and others inside the circle that the group was a badass feminist group that was meant to help women build discipline and overcome their intimacy issues. And one of DOS's members was an actress named Nikki Klein, and she appeared in Battlestar Galactica. And then there was Rosa Laura Junco, who was the heiress to a Mexican publishing fortune. And Rosa was so devoted to Keith that she offered him her teenage daughter, Loris, as his DOS servant and virgin successor.
So, and DOS really does epitomize the hubris and gluttony of Keith Raniere and Nancy Saltzman.
Part of the pattern that we saw when we started to look at the roughly 15 years, I believe, that it was in operation, is this increasing need or desire to control the people in the organization and around him. So a lot, like most of the FBI's investigation really focused on the final year or two of NXIVM, when they created this secret women's group called DOS, where they were branding women, where Keith had, you know, created this kind of bizarre pyramid scheme based on blackmail. And that, you know, when you look at it, it looks inevitable that the thing is going to crumble. I mean, it required the devotion of everyone within that system to stay loyal to it the whole time and to start, you know, that they were blackmailing women to have sex with him. They were coercing women to be branded on their body. So it seems like that was not part of early NXIVM. You know, that kind of level of control, even though there were other things that were going on and very cult-like things that were going on in the group, is certainly in terms of the psychology of it. It seems like, you know, I'm speculating here, but it seems like his desire to control the people around him, maybe the fear that they were going to leave. You know, one expert says that that's not an uncommon thing. It's kind of this like diminishing returns for people that need that kind of control of people, that you have to keep wrapping it up. So there was a kind of inevitability that it was going to crumble.
So it's no surprise that DOS would ultimately be NXIVM's undoing and Keith Raniere's undoing.
It started with internal criticism of the group from outspoken members. Keith solved these initial problems rather easily. He had the sisters, Claire and Sarah Bronfman, bankroll the group's lawsuits against detractors and critics. Now you have to realize that these weren't legitimate lawsuits. But all you need to do to make a case go forward is provide enough evidence to allow a case to go to trial, which wasn't impossible. So the Bronfman-funded lawsuits were intended to, and they ultimately did, completely decimate NXIVM critics. Because financially, how do you fight against the billionaire Bronfmans who can just file frivolous lawsuits against you to their heart's content? And this was a big strategy of theirs.
And although the Bronfman sisters managed to help Keith Raniere fend off the preliminary defectors, slowly more and more members of NXIVM started to turn on Keith. It wasn't until 2017 that any real progress was made in exposing NXIVM and taking legal recourse against Keith and the group's inner circle.
As the organization started, you know, things basically started to unravel when Sarah appeared on the front page of the New York Times, you know, pulling down the flap of her jeans to show the brand on her body. And that, on the heels of that, in fact, the FBI said it was because of that article that they launched an investigation. And of course, you know, so they start investigating, you have lots of other media starting to pay attention. And at that point, it really changed for us. We realized that it wasn't going to be the case of this like one media company doing an investigation into an organization that was in operation. Now they were like on the defensive. Keith and a bunch of the other members like moved to Mexico for a while.
Things started to unravel when Sarah Edmondson worked up the strength to speak publicly about what she'd been through, which culminated in a New York Times article titled "Inside a Secretive Group Where Women Are Branded." And this was written by Barry Meyer. Running parallel to the release of this article was the creation of the Escaping Nexium podcast, which our First Degree Josh and Sarah teamed up on.
In addition to Sarah coming forward, several former members had asked state authorities to investigate the group's practices. But until Sarah went public, officials declined to pursue any real action.
Keith and Allison Mack ordered their followers to delete encrypted messages between them and erase Google documents. And to those considering breaking away, it was not clear whom they could trust and who were Nexium loyalists.
And while there is nothing good to be said about DOS, this group where unspeakable things happened to these women, what happened in that group ultimately finally led to a teeny tiny silver lining. It was the only group where they were actually able to facilitate charges, like real charges against Keith. It's how they got law enforcement to pay attention. So in a 2018 federal complaint that was issued, it was stated the following. Ranieri, known as, quote, the Vanguard, took part in forming a secretive group within Nexium in which women said they were coerced into joining a slave master club and later branded with a design that included the initials of Ranieri and Allison Mack. An arrest warrant was issued, but Keith was in hiding in Mexico by this time. Luckily, Mexican officials helped U.S. authorities track him down to a luxury $10,000 a week villa near Puerto Vallarta, Mexico, where he was staying with several of his female followers. Finally, Keith Ranieri was under arrest. And according to the New York Times, the defendant was uncooperative when immigration authorities arrived, and after he was taken into custody, the women who he was with at this villa chased the car he was taken away in, and they followed it in their own car at high speed. They did a high-speed chase behind Keith Ranieri. That's how obsessed with him they were.
To stay close to him.
Keith and the organization faced multiple accusations of systemic sexual abuse of female members by Ranieri and members of his inner circle, leading to the arrests of Keith and other top Nexium members. The charges included sex trafficking, racketeering, and racketeering conspiracy. Ranieri was accused, among other things, of using Nexium as a recruitment network for DOS, which prosecutors referred to as a secret, quote, sex cult within Nexium.
There's lots of like sort of money-related stuff in terms of fraud and, you know, tax evasion stuff and, you know, stuff that they were up to in that side. And some, there's a whole bunch of stuff that was around falsifying documents and getting people into the country illegally. There have been claims and allegations made about Keith going way back previous to Nexium and certainly continue into Nexium about his relationship with underage girls. That's very disturbing. And, you know, he spent a lot of time in addition to like his sermons or speeches or whatever you want to call them about how men are inherently, you know, or women are inherently inferior to men. He also talked a lot about how the age of consent and having sex with minors is a kind of social construct and something that is actually just like imposed on us. And he seemed to really sanction this idea of pedophilia.
During the six-week trial, which exposed the inner workings of Keith's twisted organization, the bulk of the testimony against Keith focused on the horrific, cruel, and illegal treatment of the women in DOS. And according to the New York Times, quote, the trial was conducted under the sort of security that is usually associated with terrorists and drug lords. The jurors, whose names were withheld, were brought to and from court in vans driven by United States Marshals. Many of the witnesses were identified only by their first name.
Towards the end of the process, I mean, we end up going to his trial his initial hearing in Brooklyn. By that point, I had spent months and months, you know, thinking about him and hearing about him and talking to people that knew him and people. And, you know, he was just such a presence in my life for so long and really built up as this figure. So part of seeing him for the first time, it was strange. I mean, partly it was that quality of like, oh, like that's it? That's the person that we're talking about? Like this kind of scraggly haired, kind of goofy looking guy with these, you know, big glasses that he just doesn't seem particularly impressive, and just very human in a lot of ways. And I think that, you know, that's what can happen, is that you sort of build a figure like that up in your mind. So part of it was that. Another part of it that really struck me was that when we started the investigation, as I said, like, this organization was in full operation. He was living a great life and, you know, had access to his private jet and to his many female sexual partners and to lots of money. And here we were just, you know, not even 6 months later, and the whole thing had crumbled and fallen apart, and he's wearing a prison jumpsuit and is testifying in court. So it was quite, you know, it really struck me sitting in the courtroom that the way that this thing kind of unraveled right under our feet.
There was tons of incriminating evidence that was presented at trial.
There was evidence that members of NXIVM, at Keith's command, quote, hacked into computer accounts and paid private investigators in an effort to obtain personal information on perceived enemies, including Senator Chuck Schumer. So these people are seriously diabolical.
Listen, I know he got a 2-point whatever GPA. I know he's not the sharpest tool in the shed. He's sharp enough, because this is some crazy shit. I mean, he's sharp enough to... And you know, celebrities don't matter against billionaires. Is what the Bronfmans were. And recruiting them changed everything for Keith. You know what I mean? Because it's like, they could pay hackers to do whatever they wanted. Like, they could fight any legal battle.
Well, you also don't need to be textbook smart to be like a manipulative sociopath.
No. I mean, look at what Manson was. Manson certainly wasn't textbook smart.
And Ted Bundy. But... Yeah.
Right. Right. Well, in this case, the evidence against Keith and the organization included seized documents, emails, audio recordings, and testimony from more than a dozen people, many who were former sex captives of Keith Raniere. And after closing arguments, the jury was sent out for deliberation, which only lasted pretty much a half a day. And for a 6-week trial, that's not that long to deliberate. So when they returned, it was announced that the now 59-year-old, washed up, self-help guru, sad hippie man Keith Raniere was found guilty of racketeering, sex trafficking, conspiracy, forced labor, identity theft, sexual exploitation of a child, and possession of child pornography. Allison Mack, Claire Bronfman, and 3 other women and top members of NXIVM pleaded guilty to a slew of charges prior to the commencement of Keith's trial. So, I know you're probably wondering how much time a cult leader gets for shenanigans like this, but his sentencing is scheduled for the 23rd of this month in 2020. So a few weeks from now, pending the implications from COVID, because this is New York, so it'll really depend on whether or not they are backlogged. And because this happened before COVID, the information we received, you know? So who knows if this will actually happen, but he's slated to be sentenced ASAP, pending room in court.
Hope he burns in hell.
At the center of this story, and the thing that drew me into it, was like, wait a second, how does this person who, you know, grew up in the same community as me and at the same level of education and, same degree of security, I think, you know, how does she end up signing up for a personal growth workshop one day and then, you know, 12 years later is being branded on her body with this guy's initials, and what's going on there? And not obviously just her, but there, many of the people that end up in this organization are not obviously people that you think would get sucked into these kind of things. I mean, I don't think everyone would be sucked into NXIVM. Like, I think NXIVM was really good at weeding out who, you know, that's the whole point of having those workshops and kind of sussing out like who are our prime candidates. But I do think that there is some kind of version of a coercive organization that could, at the right point in someone's life, could pull you in. I don't think anyone's immune to that. I do think it plays into like a universal human fallibility. And also just this notion like, that there's some hidden secret to what can make us happy and what can make us achieve the things we want to achieve. But like somehow, like in the year 2020, it's like, oh, no, we've got it. And like, it's crazy because no one's figured it out. But like, this is the, you know, that that really narrow-minded notion of like, no one else gets it and this is the answer, and or this like adoration of a particular figure that can deliver to you, it just is like, I feel like how many more times do we have to learn the lesson that that's not a great path to be going down.
Nobody joins a cult thinking they're joining a cult. Nobody. The thing is about cults, and what's so smart about their leaders generally, is they know how to appeal to the hierarchy of human needs, everything that human beings need to feel safe, accepted, loved. And they learn how to tap into that, and they also learn how to target people who are lacking one or many of those.
We talk about in the podcast, this, my poli-sci friend talk, you know, in poli science, political science, they call it ontological security. Like, it's a huge amount of security to know the world is ordered and that there's reasons that things happen. You know your place in the world. And it's just like, it's easier to walk through life that way, but then there's consequences of seeing the world through that lens. But the fact that, here's my segue, the fact that there's so many iterations of it is sort of evidence of how susceptible we all are, because we see these cycles of these organizations coming and going and being scandalized and shutting down, and then other versions of them popping up because of how attractive the idea is to be told that you have answers and that there's a simple solution, which is how I ended up in some ways being drawn into this new story, this new podcast that I'm doing with NBC. It's called The Lost Kids. And it's a story that they had. I mean, I think they approached me with it because of Nexium, and there is a cultic link, although this one is surprising because it's the cultic element to it is for many people was quite hidden. So this new series is actually about something called the troubled teen industry, which is this $1 billion industry that promises to be able to fix, you know, wayward teens who are suffering from anything from depression to, you know, school avoidance behavior, they call it, to ADD, to, you know, just being a rebel. I didn't realize I kind of knew about it, but my like first understanding of it came through talk shows in like the 80s and 90s, where you'd have, you know, that classic story. They did it again and again, where they have, you know, so-and-so is like druggy and swears at her mom, and they bring her out on stage, and then they send her off to some boot camp and run her through a bunch of drills and have sergeants screaming in her face. And then, you know, sure enough, 3 months later, she comes back and she's totally reformed and changed. And that program, those kind of boot camp programs, are one version of this whole ecosystem of wilderness programs and boot camps and these residential facilities, these things they call therapeutic boarding schools, that promise to take your kid and use tough love to fix them. In any event, so the cultic connection is that it turns out the whole philosophical foundation for these programs links back to this, what started as a drug addiction program in the 1950s in California called Synanon, that ended up becoming what some experts call America's most dangerous cult. I mean, they were trying to kill detractors if they're a rattlesnake in the mailbox of one of the lawyers that was going after them. They were full on cult. But they collapsed and fell apart in the 90s, but their philosophy lived on, and a lot of the followers went off and started other programs, especially working with troubled teens. And there's some really interesting work that like links back all these connections, how kind of all roads lead back to Synanon. Now, when you send your kid to a program like this, of course, that's not the pitch you're getting. It's not overt, you know, not only the link to Synanon often, but also the kind of therapy that they were, the so-called therapy, I suppose, that they were using in these programs. So the specific story that we're looking at is the 16-year-old kid from New Jersey who was from a loving middle-class family. He was, you know, did decently enough in school, and he, in his teens, what happened to him happens to a lot of kids. He started to suffer from mental health issues and dropped out of school. He was depressed. He couldn't get out of bed. His parents took him to a psychiatrist and psychologist, and they all kind of said he has adolescent depression, and he wasn't getting better, and his parents were quite desperate. They could see the school year was flying by, and he was failing out of it. And in a moment of desperation, the dad Googles like programs for struggling teens, and up pops this website for a program called Sea-Doo Running Springs, up in the mountains of California. And it looked beautiful. There's beautiful pictures of the landscape and kids smiling, and it was just, you know, it also looked very different from the world they lived in New Jersey. And this kid, Daniel, even agreed that he would go out and try it. It was a 2-year program, and they promised they could help. And he only lasted for 10 days at the program before running away, and he's never been found again. And that was sort of the starting point of our investigation to say, well, you know, what's going on here? What was this program he got sent to? And it turns out that hundreds of kids run away from this place because what they're doing inside there is this crazy form of attack therapy that essentially pits. Some people describe it as like a kind of Lord of the Flies almost, like where they pit residents against each other in these epic 3-hour group therapy sessions where a whole group will essentially attack someone on a hot seat, telling them how worthless they are, that they're a slut, that their parents don't love them, that they, you know, just ripping them apart until that person has a kind of cathartic emotional breakdown, screaming into the floor, like snot and tears coming out of their eyes. And that's it. That's the therapy. That's the extent of it. And then you go on to the next person, and you are attacked in this process, but you also are made to be an active participant in it. There's no sitting on the sidelines, or you face all kinds of punishment. So this is, you know, that's the therapeutic foundation of the work they do. And so it's not surprising that kids very quickly get the hell out of there, like really fast. And it's up in the mountains of San Bernardino, so it's not the safest place to flee. So really, our investigation starts with Daniel Ewan and his story, but we start to peel back the layers of like, well, how is it that this kid from New Jersey starts suffering depression, gets flown across the world to a program running this very controversial form of therapy that's actually been in operation for, you know, almost 4 decades, and starting to kind of unpack the layers of like what this place is and its position within this whole billion-dollar industry.
I think it's fascinating that Josh is looking at other abuses of power, because obviously cults aren't always packaged like cults. You know, Keith Raniere, NXIVM, once you dig in, very obviously a cult, but there's something very culty about this industry, not only of what behavioral therapy and like, you know, kids, boot camps who are bad kids, things like that, but also rehab. You know, these are unregulated, and this has been a very fascinating subject for me for a really long time. So lucky for everybody listening, The Lost Kids is already out. They all came out on June 3rd, and it is now June 10th, so you can go binge them right now. Thank you so much, Josh Block, for coming on The First Degree. We enjoyed you so, so much. We loved Escaping NXIVM. You're an incredible podcast maker, incredible storyteller, and it was a delight to have you shed some additional light on this fascinating and terrifying cult. And if any of you out there listening are wondering right now whether or not you're in a cult, I'm going to leave you with a quote from Stephen Colbert. Quote, here's an easy way to figure out if you're in a cult. If you're wondering whether you're in a cult, the answer is yes.
Thank you so much, Josh, for being our First Degree connection for this episode. If anybody out there would like to tell their story, please email us hello@thefirstdegreepodcast.com. Please follow us on Instagram @thefirstdegree, @AlexisLinkletter, @BillyJensen, @JackVanek. Join our Facebook group by searching The First Degree and come chat with us about true crime. And no killing time for this week, but we'll be back up and running next week.
And remember, Only you can prevent serial killers and keep your friends close.
But not that close.
Happy ballpoint pen day. I have a good ballpoint pen in my purse.